Okay, on to Haggai then. Does that sound reasonable? Okay. If you have a study Bible, on the top of 518, you have one of those handy little zoomed in timelines. And if you don't, that's okay. You just have to listen carefully. We, as I said at the beginning of class, we really shift gears with Haggai because heretofore, at least as far as I can remember, maybe there's one exception, we are dealing with pre-exilic books. Either they're forewarning the coming of Assyria or the coming of Babylon, or both. And what we do in Haggai is we zoom forward. Assyria's come, Babylon's come, the temple's destroyed, that's it. So we really pick up with a new era here in the book of Haggai. And as we said, really what follows, Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi, and all of these are books that take place during the exile at the rebuilding of the temple, looking to what comes next. Which, of course, the next big thing after the rebuilding of the temple, after this whole saga, you have the intertestamental period. The next big thing, of course, is the coming of Christ. So we're in the last era or epoch or a major event before the coming of Christ himself. So, again, if you have that handy study note, that handy timeline, great. If not, I'll just read briefly. 605 BC, Nebuchadnezzar besieges Jerusalem. That's the beginning of the end of the southern kingdom. That is its exile. Okay. Babylon comes in and takes over. But Babylon's rule over Jerusalem is short-lived because, as God foretold centuries earlier through the prophet Isaiah, he's going to raise up Cyrus and the Persian Empire. Cyrus and the Persian Empire come in and conquer the Babylonians. So you'll notice that in 538, we're talking about 27 years later, Cyrus is in control, and Cyrus has a different attitude, all caused because of the Lord. So Cyrus decrees that the exiles may return to Judah. So if it's 587 that the temple is destroyed, okay, then 538 they're allowed to start rebuilding it. You can do the math, but it's about 50 years, right? About 50 years of no temple, about 50 years of exile before they're able to start rebuilding the temple. Which means, and this is important for Haggai, which means that there were some who, as young people, as children even, maybe even teenagers, saw Solomon's temple in all of its glory and knew that it was destroyed and got hauled off to Babylon. And now they, as adults, are being called back to rebuild and see the second temple, the rebuilt temple.
And that's why they cried, right?
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, exactly right. Yeah. So Cyrus decrees that they can go rebuild in 538. But if you were listening to the sermon last night, you know, it's a little overly simplified. But the bottom line is God is saying to his people under Babylon and under Cyrus, get out, go rebuild the temple, go do your thing. And the people go, they don't really want to. And so Haggai is sent in 520 to light a fire under them and say, no, this temple is going to get rebuilt, we're going to do it right now. And the main thrust of how Haggai begins his argument, again, it comes from the Lord, is, look, you all are building cushy houses for yourself. Meanwhile, the house of the Lord is a heap. So let's get busy. And you can tell from the timeline that by 516, the second temple is completed. So the prophesying of Haggai had great effect. And of course, Haggai's not alone. Zechariah is there. I don't mean to be biased, but I think Zechariah is the much more fascinating book, and that's where we go next. But they're like companion books. You know, Haggai and Zechariah are both working at about the same time, and they both have the same point. People, let's go. Rebuild the temple. Yeah, like Hodel and Rhody. No. No. Yeah, that right. They were contemporaries.
The people
yeah.
who were
were doubting that they could do it or should do it or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And of course, as I mentioned earlier, you have Daniel, who is around at this time, you know, and he gets thrown in the lion's den for not worshiping the Babylonian god, right? And I think Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that whole story takes place in this era in their captivity. So this is coming out of all that, but this is all that those events are recent history, fresh in the minds of the people. So Haggai is doing his thing in 520, and it's pretty effective because the temple gets built in 516. But then again, and I didn't look this up before class, but you remember when Christ goes in with his whips and cleanses the temple in Holy Week, and then he says, destroy this temple in 3 days, I'll raise it up again. And they said, will you raise it up in 3 days when it's taken us 40 years, 30 years? I forget what exactly they said. Do you recall the number? Does anybody recall the specific number?
No, but wasn't that the Herod's temple?
Yeah, exactly.
So it wasn't this.
It wasn't this temple. But the point that I'm getting at is Herod's temple was taking decades to complete. This temple, the second temple, is completed in 516. I mean, let's say they sort of got started before Haggai, which they probably did. But then efforts lagged, and they decided this thing's never going to get built. And then Haggai and Zechariah go. It's a pretty short time frame. So this temple was probably less spectacular even than Herod's version of it. And now it's my understanding that this temple is the second temple, and that this temple is never thoroughly destroyed like to its foundation, the way the first temple was. But this temple is renovated and reclaimed by Herod and his efforts. And so much so that, remember, the disciples are walking by and they admire the great stones of the temple, and they say this to Jesus. And Jesus says, does that impress you? The day's coming when these will all be tossed down, right? And he's foretelling the destruction of 70, which is in 70 AD, which is the destruction of the second temple, this temple, and that's the end of the temple, up until this very day.
So, there are three temples?
Sure.
This is the second temple. It doesn't have a name. Just the rebuilding of the second temple.
Yeah, it's just most commonly called the second temple.
And when was it destroyed there, or partially destroyed? What year was it, or what was it?
I don't know the specific circumstances that lead to Herod doing his major. I don't know whether it would even be proper to call it a rebuild or a renovation or whatever he does.
So he may have torn it down and rebuilt it up.
I doubt that he raised it, like that he completely destroyed it.
It wasn't an army or anything.
Not to my knowledge. I mean, if anybody knows different or hears different, I'd love to know those details, from my own knowledge, because I don't think so. I mean, you're talking about hundreds of years. Of course, this is 500, and by the time Herod's around, you're talking that's 500 years. So I'm guessing that Herod was doing a major renovation project, and thus it was being called Herod's Temple, which was kind of an abomination anyway, because Herod was like this pretend Jewish king, this pagan, this obnoxious guy that zealots, like, you know, if I was around then, Judas Iscariot and I would have been friends, I would have hated this guy's guts, and I would have been rebelling against this whole thing. And the idea of Herod having a temple would be like, yeah, I mean, gosh, let's invite the Dalai Lama to help us redesign Faith Lutheran Church. You know, what business does he have here? Would be my sort of outlook, and sort of the outlook of the zealous Jews of the time. I think they hated Herod and they hated this whole thing.
You mean Barabbas or Judas Iscariot? Which one?
Well, in the sense that depending on how you take his name, and depending on which piecing together of history you believe, it's argued that Judas may well have been a zealot, that his last name may depict that, similar to Bar Abbas being a zealot. In fact, if you dig into it, I mean, all of this is a bit speculative, but it's unusual. The way that the English translates the thieves on the cross, you know, that Jesus was next to two thieves, and I forget the specific word that's used now in Greek. But that word, but when you think about it, when you just think about it, it's odd. There are a lot of thieves in the Roman Empire. There are a lot of thieves around Jerusalem. Why are these two guys, are they pickpockets? Are they the Bernie Madoffs of their day? Well, why are these guys getting what Jesus is getting when Jesus is getting basically treason? I mean, that's the king of the Jews, right? That's the justification, is this guy was a usurper. It was treason, and that's why he's getting this harsh punishment. So what are these thieves next to him? So the more you think about that, the more it's not really satisfying, just superficially. But then as you go deeper into the study of that word that's used for thieves, it's the same word, I believe, that's used for Barabbas on one occasion. And that word that is commonly translated as thief can often mean rebel. And when you sort of piece that together, when you sort of look at this whole exegetical argument that's made, that again I've only read and forgotten most of it, when you look at this whole article, it paints a lot more convincing picture that these guys are being crucified next to Jesus because they were rebels, they're insurrectionists, not because they were like pickpockets or Bernie Madoffs. They were insurrectionists. Jesus was the chief insurrectionist, the king of the Jews, the so-called king of the Jews, and so high treason, he was put to death, and they were insurrectionists and put to death. And of course, then I've covered the history with Barabbas, which isn't so speculative. That's pretty concrete, where Barabbas isn't, you know, this seething mass murderer like he's, or crazy person like he's depicted in all the movies, but Barabbas meaning son of the father, he is a messianic figure that views the kingdom coming through force, through the sword. And Jesus is another son of the father who refuses to bring the kingdom about through the sword, whose kingdom is not of this world. And the people, what's posed to the people, by the way, it's not the same people who were there welcoming him in Jerusalem. That's also a caricature and wrong. That the crowd, like, on Sunday, on Palm Sunday, was saying, yay, and on Good Friday was saying, kill him. That's just wrong. But the people gathered there were presented with a choice between Barabbas and Jesus. And the choice wasn't this seething mass murderer, little peaceful doe-eyed Jesus. The choice was, do you want this Messiah or that Messiah? Do you want the one who comes with the sword, or do you want the one who comes in peace? From the people's perspective, we'll take the sword, thank you very much. Crucify Jesus, we want Barabbas. We want that son of the Father. So it's a very stunning, that name, once you translate, it's a very stunning exchange. Much more that meets the eye. Anyway, like I said, in one of the Gospels, a word is used for Barabbas that's the same word we translate as thief for the thieves on the cross, which is pretty good evidence that those thieves on the cross would be better translated as insurrectionists on the cross.
But Jesus was killed mainly because of the Jewish people, because the Pharisees and the priests built a story that made it impossible for Rome to do anything but to kill them.
I don't think that's right in this way. I would agree generally with what you're saying, except Pilate knew that their story was baloney. And Pilate, in cross-examining him, knew that it was baloney and found the witnesses to be full of errors.
But he didn't have the guts to rise up against.
Right. And in fact, the Jews, rather than convincing Jesus by case, shout at Pilate, well, you're no friend of Caesar. In other words, maybe you're the insurrectionist, Pilate. Maybe you ought to be on the cross. At which point, Pilate seems pretty quickly to say, okay, him, not me.
But the thieves that were crucified with Jesus weren't... That wasn't instigated by the Jewish people. That would have been because of Rome. Mm-hmm. They had done something against Rome, correct?
Probably Jewish insurrectionists against Rome, because, again, that's the chief tension that's going on in Jerusalem and in that region, is you have Roman oppressors, right, governing the Holy Land. And if you've noticed anything throughout the Minor Prophets or the Old Testament, these folks do not take kindly to being occupied by pagans, right? And so that's precisely what's going on. That's the tension. And so the Jewish people, and the Maccabean revolt of earlier history, of earlier years of the pre-testamental period, you have all sorts of wars and insurrections and attempts to overthrow the Roman oppressors. And so that tension is consistent, and that's really the, from a human perspective, from a political perspective, the boiling pot that Jesus is in, you know, where he sounds just insurrectionist enough to alert Rome, but not insurrectionist enough to please the people. So he ends up sort of an enemy of both. Okay, well, I guess we didn't even start Haggai.
We're ready, though.
We're ready. We're excited. Okay, next week, Haggai. The Lord be with you.
And also with you.
Thank you.
Pastor Rody, what